Hare Krishna. Welcome to the second day of the Srila Prabhupada Festival, 23rd. We're very honored again to have the presence of His Grace Yogeshwar Prabhu, who we introduced yesterday. He's been a devotee since 1969, initiated in 1970, had been president of the Paris Temple, the founder of Bala Books for Children. He's a professor where? At the Long Island. And he's a great intellect in the Hare Krishna movement. Without further ado, we're going to have an hour and a half of nectar at 12 o'clock. We'll stop. I want to thank Yogeshwar Prabhu for coming, and we hope that he'll come on many more occasions and share more nectar. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna. Part of the the responsibility that comes with having known Srila Prabhupada, as we started to talk about yesterday, is to preserve and to perpetuate those moments that we had with him. And in pursuit of that obligation, my dear godbrother Yadubara and I chose to create biographies. Yadubara doing his documentary film about Srila Prabhupada, and my own humble effort to try and create a what you might call literary nonfiction, a biography of Prabhupada that will appeal to a general readership, because the writing contains some of the protocols and tools of a literary storytelling. I tried to do that with the George Harrison biography, Here Comes the Sun. And this is, I thought I would read a couple of pages to you just to give you an idea of the flavor of the language in this. So the book goes from start to finish focusing on the years leading up to 1977. And the idea in many works of biography is to create tension and interest by giving the story historic housing, creating moments of curiosity, an intimation of a problem that needs to be solved, something that earns readers' interest so that they'll stay with you for the next however many hours it takes to read this book. So you have to give them something right up front that's going to grab them. And so if, with your permission, I'll read you a work in progress. It's just a few pages from this biography that I'm attempting to write about Srila Prabhupada. So imagine that you open the book, and the front page, the first page that you come to after the title, at the top it says, Calcutta, 1910. And I owe this particular opening anecdote to my dear godbrother, Hari Sori Prabhu. The rude scaffolding of iron and bamboo thrust its way up into the black night sky hanging over Calcutta. Eventually, the confusion of stones and poles would become the Victoria Monument, Britain's declaration of dominance over India. But now, while still under construction, it looked more like an amateur web woven by giant spiders. Streets were quiet at this late hour. It was forbidden to enter the site, but rules never held Abai back before. He climbed the crisscross of beams hand over hand, eventually reaching the wood-planked summit, and stared out over the city to the sea and the world beyond. He was 14. It would take more than a half century before he could set sail across those waters. Abai was not impatient to see the world. he had a nation to rescue. And then it goes into chapter 1. And at the top of the chapter it says, New York City, 1966. 30-year-old Howard Reeler, on his way from teaching English at New York University, had no idea who this person might be. Wheeler had been to India, exploring the country which had inspired the 19th century transcendentalists, and more recently his hero, poet Allen Ginsberg. So he knew what a Hindu monk in robes looked like, but what was one doing on the streets of the Bowery, New York's most derelict neighborhood? Wheeler stood over 6 feet tall. He had flowing black hair, a thick beard, and spoke with a southern accent left over from a Florida childhood. He watched the man in robes strolling almost jauntily down the sidewalk, he described, and noted with amusement his pointy white rubber shoes. On the man's nose were two vertical streaks of white clay that ran north and dead-ended at his shaved head. His robes were saffron-colored, and his right hand was encased in a cloth bag. Had he heard it? Wheeler walked across the Bowery and approached him. The man in robes was looking south on 2nd Avenue, eyes bright, head held high, impervious to stares, and with what Wheeler described as, quote, the bearing of a great actor in a famous movie. Are you from India? Wheeler asked, obvious, but not knowing what else to say. Oh, yes, the man said. A bus drove by, blowing exhaust around them like a cloud of incense. And you? Wheeler felt sorry for this grandfatherly gentleman so far from home. Why was he here? Where did he live? Was anyone taking care of him? They walked a few blocks to 2nd Avenue and 1st Street, and with one finger, not covered by the cloth bag, the man pointed to a small storefront wedged between a gas station and a funeral home. Farther down the block, Wheeler noted the Red Star Bar, one of hundreds servicing Greenwich Village's pungent population of derelicts. Wheeler looked above the door of the storefront and saw the words Matchless Gifts painted in red. Apparently, the former tenant had run a curio shop. Now a sign in the window announced lectures on Bhagavad Gita, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 7 to 9 p.m., A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami. So the man was indeed a Hindu teacher, a Swami. Wheeler cupped his hands and looked through the window. The shop was maybe 15 feet wide and 40 feet long. A few straw mats, a bare light bulb hanging from the ceiling, and that was about it. He turned to the elderly gentleman and was met with a big smile. Whoever this man was, he had a child's look of innocent optimism, which struck Wheeler as out of place amid the drugs and filth and promiscuousness of Greenwich Village in the mid-60s. Yet the Swami also seemed to fit in with a seamlessness which Wheeler could not define. A.C. Bhaktivedanta, he described, suddenly appears in our backyard as if the whole chaotic stage had been deliberately, specifically set for him. Wheeler promised to come back. He said goodbye and puzzled over the meeting on the walk to his apartment on nearby Mott Street. Wheeler's roommates were there. He told them about the encounter. Wally Sheffy, a recording engineer, rolled his eyes. There were so many Hindus, Buddhists, and who knows what all showing up these days claiming to have a handle on truth. In 1965, the year before, Congress had repealed the Asian Exclusion Act, which for the previous 60 years had prohibited all but a few Indians from living in America. With the act's repeal, the doors to America swung open and in flowed a wave of Asian teachers. Just what we need, Sheffy said, another spiritual master. Is he a guru? Asked Keith Ham. An avatar? What? Ham was a preacher's son working on a doctorate in American religious history. He walked with careful steps and an exaggerated swing of his hips left over from polio contracted as a child. Wheeler shrugged. Let's go Monday and find out. The following Monday, they arrived at 7 p.m. and took their seats on straw mats. There were maybe a dozen other people, mostly young, 20-ish. A few minutes later, the Swami entered through a door at the rear of the shop. He was dressed as when Wheeler first met him, saffron-colored cloth wrapped around his waist and cotton shawl draped over his shoulders. The Swami sat down on one of the straw mats and from his pocket withdrew two circular discs maybe 3 inches across. The discs were held together by a length of cloth threaded through small holes in the middle. He wrapped the thin cloth around his pointer fingers and tapped the hand symbols gently together. Ching, ching, ching. He closed his eyes and sang. What was he singing? No one seemed to know. Then, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Simple words, a simple melody, 4 notes over and over, something they could imitate and repeat. He waved the hand symbols, encouraging the group to chant in response, then closed his eyes again. After several minutes, he ended the chant, opened his eyes, and smiled. In my childhood, he said, I first heard about America in geography and history classes. By hearing, I understood, oh, a wonderful country, very far away. If I go there, I will see big buildings and many motor cars. I had some mental conception by hearing. Similarly, if you want to see God, you must first hear about God from the proper source, from the lips of a pure devotee. The name Krishna means the all-attractive. God is not an old man, the Swami said. Why should he be old? He is eternal, changeless, ever fresh, ever youthful. Krishna is the supreme personality of Godhead. We are his parts and parcels. God is great. We are small. We share God's qualities, just as a spark has all the qualities of the fire, but in minute quantity. Still, we can know God. How? By chanting. Because he is absolute, God and his names are not different. By chanting Hare Krishna, you are actually associating with Krishna. And what is the proof? When you chant, you become blissful. Krishna is full of bliss, and you are also blissful by nature. Just try to understand. He spoke clearly, articulating his words. Wheeler appreciated the effort, but there were ideas here that did not compute. Could the Swami possibly mean what he meant by Krishna being the supreme God? Wheeler had posters from India in which Krishna was depicted as a blue-skinned cowherd with a feather in his hair, playing a flute and dancing with the girls of his village. On the shelves of his Mott Street apartment were books of Hindu philosophy that described Krishna as, quote, the hero of countless legends. Wheeler had always understood Krishna in that way, a folk hero or a literary symbol meant to help beginning yogis envision their deeper impersonal self. The Swami was saying Krishna is not a myth, but the supreme personality of Godhead. Wheeler had never heard anyone speak about Krishna literally as the origin of anything. God, a blue-skinned boy who played a flute? Throughout the talk, the Swami supported his statements with verses from the Bhagavad Gita and other Sanskrit texts. It was clear he wanted guests to know these were not his own ideas. They had scriptural pedigree. As provocative as his talk was, not everyone stayed. The gathering had started at 7 p.m. By 9:30, half the guests had left. The Swami stopped his lecture, sliced an apple, arranged the pieces on a metal plate, and passed it around. A touching bit of hospitality to Wheeler's way of thinking. Maybe even more. That little tray of apples, sliced and served, seemed to epitomize what they were in that little shop and in that moment in the history of America. And no one would have known from this enclave of seekers sitting with their teacher and sharing an apple that there were such things as poverty and suffering and a whole nation on the edge from the constant chill of the Cold War. Have you ever heard of LSD? Wheeler asked. No, the Swami said. It's a chemical, Wheeler said. Some people claim that it can give religious insights or ecstasies. Do you think it could be helpful in spiritual life? The Swami shook his head. You don't need to take anything for your spiritual life. Your spiritual life is already here. Wheeler was stunned. The notion that you don't need to take anything for your spiritual life struck him hard. As far as he was concerned, up to that moment, there could be no spiritual life without taking something, the right drug, the right pilgrimage, the right philosophy. Had hallucinogens not been part of spiritual traditions throughout recorded history? Had the great poets, including his beloved Ginsberg, not all gone to India or Tibet or the mountains of Mexico to deepen their spiritual life? To find truth, seekers had always traveled either inside or out. Wheeler had carefully constructed a spiritual identity for himself based on that assumption and on the fruits of his travels. Along comes this diminutive teacher with a big smile, and over goes the apple cart. Your spiritual life is already here. Yes, it certainly is, Wheeler thought. Standing before the most exalted personality he had ever beheld and feeling a tug in his chest, a crack in his usual cynicism. Maybe this is what awakening is supposed to feel like, he thought. So weighted was the moment that a few years later, when he looked back on it, the Swami himself would comment, "It was our first meeting, and I think it was eternal." The air around Matchless Gifts was thick with the smell of urine and cheap booze and open garbage cans, and up and down the block there were taxis and trucks adding fumes to the mix. In the morning, the Swami walked to nearby markets, purchasing tiny portions of vegetables and butter. On return, he would sometimes find someone sleeping off a bender in the doorway. Wheeler arrived at such a moment one morning and found the Swami looking down calmly on a man passed out on the stoop. "My dear sir," the Swami said to his unconscious visitor, "please get up." Wheeler froze. The concern and affection in the Swami's voice at that moment embodied for the tall New Yorker everything he had ever imagined about sainthood. To love what was broken and scorned and tossed aside. To honor what smelled rank and what nobody else would touch. Because beneath the illusion of the mess and the odor lived an eternal soul, part and parcel of Krishna. What could this derelict possibly have done in this life or in others to merit such grace? Wheeler knew he had to stay with the Swami. He had to know more. And a few pages from. So. Okay. So that may be a good example of something that we could follow up on after yesterday's talk about the nature of memory. What happens when history is appropriated by creative minds? What happens when what actually occurred becomes filtered through the lens of what we would have liked to have occurred? What gets sacrificed when we attempt to commodify history in an effort to make it more appealing or more available to a wide public? There are risks. There are risks and there are rewards. The rewards, of course, are that maybe by making something more literary or more palatable, you can get more people to ask more about it. The risk is that the more you water something down, the more you commodify it, the more you appropriate it, or worse, misappropriate it for some agenda, for some end, the farther you go away from the reality. And at some point, you begin to compromise that reality. And that's a risk. That's a risk. So those are some of the things that we have to balance out when we talk about our memories with Srila Prabhupada. You know, I can tell you a small anecdote, and I can exaggerate what happened, you know, for the sake of humor, for the sake of engaging you with that story. Well, maybe I'm doing a disservice to that moment. You know, maybe I've got my own needs there. I want to somehow give you a good experience. I go through this all the time when I'm teaching. I want my students to have a good time. I want them to, you know, get into it. So I'm a bit of a showman, you know. I'll get up there and do my song and dance and try and make something interesting for them. But you always have to be careful. You know, you're crossing that line into running risks. I remember, in terms of running risks, one time in Paris, George Harrison had a friend in Paris named Maxine. Maxine, she ran nightclubs. She had earned her money in an ancient profession. And with her wealth, she opened a few clubs. There was one club in Montmartre called New Jimmy. I don't know why she called it that. But she met us and said, I'd like to throw a soirée indienne for you devotees, your friends of George. So come to see me at my club Friday night at midnight. So, all right, time out here. New Jimmy, okay, you know, it was in all the papers, was a club frequented by, you know, the society of Paris. Short didn't describe what skirts were in those days. The word doesn't begin to describe, but there wasn't a skirt, there was a handkerchief, you know, like. And the floor of New Jimmy was made of mirrors. So I went to Prabhupada and I said, look, here's the situation. George has a friend. She wants to do something for us to help build a temple. What should we do? And he thought for a minute and he said, go fishing. Just don't get wet. So, you know, he was somebody for everything. You have to take some risks. You have to take some risks. There's no way that we can bring Krishna consciousness to a larger world without taking some risks. But he wanted those risks to be carefully calibrated and preferably determined in the sangha of devotees. Right? Then we have something going here. Okay. Were there any questions after our talk yesterday, after our discussion yesterday? Did anybody want to raise any? Is that Kanka? What night?
When you went fishing.
Oh, in Paris.
When you went fishing.
Nothing happened. We went there at midnight, you know, and she was table hopping, you know, for about an hour. And so we're sitting there just waiting, you know. And nothing ever came of it. I don't know. I'm not quite sure why.
Did she give a lot of money to help build the temple?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't remember at this point. No, the part that I remember was Prabhupada's instruction. He was here, go fishing. You know, he did. He came. He said, coming to the West was a transcendental gamble. I mean, he, we were talking about this earlier. Should I stay here? Should I not stay here? You know. He was going down to the bursar's office at, you know, Scindia Steamship Company, asking when's the next boat back to India. Yeah. Yeah, all right, I'll stay another week, see what happens. He was taking extreme risks. Yeah, Siddhartha?
Maybe going overboard, the risk of trying to attract people in a different fashion as opposed to a hard line, maybe philosophy. And I remember you telling a story once that you had written or drew a comic strip.
Oh, my. You're going to get me in trouble with this one again.
It's a good analogy.
Jem Sundry was the one who got me in trouble. I had a Krishna yoga club at New York University. And in order to bring students in, I had done a little cartoon, you know, handed out like a flyer. I'm not an artist, and, my ideas aren't all that great. So it was just, you know, some student, you know, with dark glasses on, and there's a devotee walking back and forth in this cartoon with a sign saying, Krishna Yoga Club starts in 3 days, starts in 2 days, starts in 1 day. Krishna Yoga Club today, and there's this whole crowd of students running toward the yoga club, and the guy with the glasses on the ground. Like these. And somehow Prabhupada got a hold of that. And he sent me back a letter saying, I don't think you need to distract yourself for unnecessary publicity. He said, stick to the purity. He He said, people have never seen such purity as we have to offer in Krishna consciousness. He says, you don't need to do anything else. That has stayed with me ever since. That there isn't any tricking out of who we are or what we do. We stand on the purity and the strength of our Krishna conscious culture. And there is nothing else that is needed. Let this be extremely clear. Because this tendency of wanting to accommodate really does have extreme risk. I ran those risks myself. I got my wrist slapped by Srila Prabhupada for trying to do that. You don't need to do that. You know, sure, do some people have some vague image of, you know, articles they read in the newspapers about bad things that were happening or books in airports? Let's just get over this already. That was a million years ago. And there may be a few people who are still feeling very bad about that. Is that where we're going to dwell, in those few places? We've got a world to conquer for Srila Prabhupada here. So, I mean, he came to Paris that first time. And after that Air India press conference that he gave, we were going back to the temple, and we were standing down in front on the Boulevard de la Madeleine, waiting for the car. The devotees had a car, so we were waiting for the car. And we knew that he had had a long day. Hari Vilas was there. He said, would you like to sit down, Srila Prabhupada? There was an outdoor cafe right next door to the Air India. And Prabhupada looked. He said, do they serve alcohol here? Well, yeah, yes, it's a cafe. I cannot sit there. He had a long day. You know, he had every right to sit on a chair. Right? But he was very conscious of who he was, what he represented, and therefore the proper behavior that he needed to exhibit. Right? All right, yes.
Hare Krishna. I remember you having a series of conversations, or maybe it was just one or two conversations with Prabhupada, about how Krishna consciousness was going to be purely presented in light of culture, in light of art. In fact, I remember you having some real opinions about art. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could share that memory.
I was always curious, very curious. You know, what does this mean? Pure devotee. What does that mean? What is he seeing that I'm not seeing? I mean, there were times we installed the deities in Paris, and he was looking at Radha Parasishwar weeping copiously, and I always wonder, what is he seeing? Then I'm looking at the same deities, but I'm not weeping. What is he seeing? What is he feeling? What's going on there in him? I didn't understand it. So I would ask him all kinds of questions. I was just very curious. And there was a time he was sitting in his room. It was Rulisuel, Fontenero's in the suburbs. And I just walked in. I said, what is art? And he looked at me and said, it's not what people usually think it is. He says, art is putting something in its proper place for best utility. I didn't know what he was saying. Art is putting something in its proper place for best utility. And I'm thinking, okay, putting something in its proper place. Well, sometimes art is taking something out of remember, you've got to remember, this is 1971 or whatever, right? Andy Warhol was very big. I said, well, there's an artist like Andy Warhol, for example. He'll take a soup can and he'll take it out of its proper place. You know, take it off of the shopping market shelf and put it on a pedestal and call it art. And Prabhupada said, well, that may be art for you, but it's not for me. And I said, well, but what about What about non-representational art? You know, there's amazing work that's been done in abstract, and, you know. He said, well, you might find this beautiful. And he took a brush, you know, like, like he was doing a splatter painting. Yeah, you might find this beautiful. I don't. You know. Okay, so he's already challenging my sense of aesthetics. I said, well, then I don't understand what you mean, that art means putting something. Yes, he said, it means putting something in its proper place. That is artist, an artist. An artist is someone who knows what the best utility of something is. He's talking about devotees. He's describing devotees as artists. He's saying a devotee is an artist. I'm saying, so by that definition, a sincere street sweeper. And he finished the sentence. I said, yes, exactly. Whatever you do, if you're doing that with love for Krishna, if you are cleaning the temple, if you are writing books, whatever you're doing, you're putting things in their proper place. That is artistic. That is artistry. And it was such a beautiful insight into the life of a devotee, into the life and thinking of a lover of God, that he lives in a world of aesthetics and beauty and art, and he sees things in terms of artistry. I mean, once you've got past the philosophizing and the sophistry, you look at Vaishnav history, you enter the realm of poetry and music and dance. I mean, that's really what our world is. It's a world of art. That was a memorable time with Prabhupada. Yeah, thank you for reminding me of that. So I wanted to talk a little bit about what does this mean for the future. And to bring it down to a nutshell, if there's one takeaway, I would say, as we remember Prabhupada, let's think in terms of what was his intent. Not just the sentiment of the event, but what was the intent behind him doing something. Everything that Prabhupada did was as a teacher. So there was something that he wanted us to understand from every moment of his time with us. And I was asking Rameshwara earlier today, what was the intent behind putting these paintings on the ceiling? Why did the devotees put these beautiful paintings on the ceiling? There must have been some thinking behind it. It didn't just, you know, by chance make their way up to the roof. And he said, yes, the idea was that people should come into the temple and they would be immersed, completely surrounded by the world of Krishna. That every place they looked, up, down, everywhere, they would be surrounded by this world of Krishna consciousness. And he said the same thinking goes into the way the Ratha Yatra is designed. So that once people enter through the gate, is it a gate, would you call it? Yeah. You can't see anything 360 degrees except Krishna. The entire panorama before you should completely exclude the material world. So behind everything, there's some intention there. So my understanding of what it means to be a pure devotee is that at every moment you see Krishna. You see the intention, you see the purpose, you see the reality beneath the apparent perception of what's going on. And I remembered a conversation that Prabhupada had in Geneva with a gentleman from the World Trade Organization. Now, the WTO is a United Nations subdivision that supervises and advises on international commerce, tariffs, trade regulations, import-export licenses, and so on. The man walked into the room, and the only thing that we had told Srila Prabhupada is that your next guest, and this was a long series of guests in that day, your next guest is coming from the World Trade Organization. The man walks in, Srila Prabhupada looks up at him and says, people want the best items at the best price, so why should we not have free trade? And I'm thinking, all right, time out, wait a minute. It wasn't computing for me. I didn't understand where he was coming from. Why did he say that? First of all, what does free trade have to do with Krishna? And Prabhupada would something. He was surprising like that. He would say something. You don't know where he was coming. And then he'd reveal it. First of all, it was the perfect icebreaker. You know, Prabhupada would know just how to bring someone into that place of, you know, ujjayi breathing, you know, it's just kind of relax into being with Prabhupada. He would find some point of tension. He did that with Donovan. When Donovan came to see Prabhupada at Bhaktivedanta Manor, Donovan came with his girlfriend, another mini dress, his bass player, and his bass player's girlfriend, and they sat there in front of Prabhupada in his room at Bhaktivedanta Manor, and Donovan was looking at Prabhupada. Prabhupada was looking at him. This went on for a few minutes, just looking at each other. And then Prabhupada went, an idea. And he quoted a verse in Sanskrit. I don't remember what it was. He says, there's a verse in the Vedas that says, music is the highest form of entertainment. No, the highest form of education. He said, music is the highest form of education. He said, therefore, you should do like your friend George. I'll give you the ideas, and you can write the songs. All right, perfect icebreaker. Immediately gave him devotional service. You know, and the whole thing was like off and running. Same thing with this gentleman from the World Trade Organization. People want the best items at the best price, so why shouldn't there be... Now, bear in mind, this was 1970, whatever. 20 years before NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement was 1994. 20 years before the euro, which came in 95, right? And here's Prabhupada, in essence, anticipating the future of economic theory. So, now, what does that mean in terms of the future of Prabhupada now? Where does that take us? Okay, we'll drill down on this for a minute and imagine, what is it that we have to say about economics? What is the Krishna conscious position on economic tools and mechanisms, monetary systems? That's a very profound subject. And, you know, there are meetings every year, global forums attempting to regulate markets and so on. We see the tragedies that can occur when markets are not properly regulated. You may recall that after the debacle of 2000, the Enron and the Arthur Andersen scandals, there was a series of laws enacted called trying to remember the name now. It'll come to me. These laws were meant Sarbanes-Oxley. Sarbanes-Oxley was essentially a mechanism for regulating business by establishing the necessity of oversight, protocols, transparency, accountability, so that the idea was, let's impose legislation on business and this will prevent another meltdown like we've just seen. Well, 2008 gave the lie to that. Why? Because just imposing laws does not change the human heart. It doesn't eradicate greed from business practice. You have to change the definition of what it means to be a human being for people to become honest in business. It just made lawyers richer because executives found ways of circumventing all these new regulations. The same thing is true in global warming. You cannot legislate a change in business practice. I've spoken to a lot of people working in this arena who say that all you have to do is show industry leaders that it makes economic sense to go green. Well, that may be a nice temporary solution, but as soon as that new green practice is no longer economically beneficial, they're going to reject it and they're going to go back to finding some other way to destroy the environment. So unless you eradicate greed and selfishness from the human heart, all of these solutions are going to be, at best, temporary. So we have a lot to say about economic theory. You go back to the founding fathers of economic theory, you know, John Adams and Adam Smith, rather, John Locke. some of the others. What you find is a desire to essentially regulate greed, a mechanism that will allow people to pursue their dreams without stepping on anyone else's toes. They never counted on how unlimited greed could be. Never an understanding of what the human mind is capable of. When people say to me, why did you get into Holocaust studies? I say, it's because I didn't understand it. People would always come up to me and say, oh, you're a Krishna devotee. You're the spiritual one. How do you reconcile that with what happened in Europe 65, 70 years ago? How do you put those two things in the same worldview? How is it possible for God to have not intervened in such extreme tragedy and horror and pain and suffering? How do you live with that dichotomy in your worldview? And I didn't have a good answer for them. When they say, well, you know, people get what they deserve. It's all karma. You know, I mean, what kind of an answer is that? There may be some background karmic architecture to the events of our lives, but to give that as an answer is about the coldest thing I can think of. So I got into Holocaust studies. And in order to understand these things better, I'm not perfect at it by any stretch, but I think I've come a little closer. Short form answer, when we turn away from our own true spiritual nature, we can fall very, very, very far. And when we reignite that spark of Krishna consciousness in our hearts, we are capable of soaring to unimaginable heights. Unimaginable what we can do on behalf of Srila Prabhupada. So thinking in terms of what these memories of Srila Prabhupada mean for the future, we have something to say about global warming. We have something to say about armed conflict. We have something to say about poverty. We have something to say about the rights of women, of the rights of children forced into rebel armies. We have something to say about everything. Our job is to find the language with which to say it. That's our job. The basics of Krishna consciousness have remained the same since the dawn of time. The language with which we express those basics, that's what evolves and changes, and that's our job. Our job is to be able to speak to different publics, as Prabhupada did, in their own particular language. And that's what we can take away from these examples. When Srila Prabhupada would meet these people, he would speak their language. He would find a point of entry. And it was absolutely brilliant. Sometimes you would sit there and you wonder, how is he going to handle this one? I mean, you know, there'd be people coming in. One man in Paris who just stood up. And it was in Prabhupada's room, was a darshan there. He stood up and he started spouting, gentlemen from India. Verse after verse from India, they say this and the teachers say that and Shankara this. And just going on and on and on and on. And Prabhupada's just sitting there, very, very patient. And then finally the man said, and Bhagavad Gita says, and Prabhupada said, yes, you have spoken correctly. And that was it. That's what he was waiting for, that little moment. He wasn't going to put this man down. He wanted to save his soul. And so he was waiting for that moment. He found that little moment and just brought him in using that verse as well. You've spoken so nicely. The extreme of the example of that in my memory was when a Sanskritist from Geneva University named Jean Herbert in English, came. This man, he was a big scholar. I mean, a big scholar. And now what's interesting about it is that he had met Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati. He had been to India in the 30s and had met Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati. And he had written books, and there was one book that he had written called Krishna the Divine Lover or something like that. And in this book, everything was a metaphor. Yeah, Krishna is a metaphor. The gopis are a metaphor. The dust raised by the hoofs of the calves is a metaphor. Everything is a metaphor. So gave the book to Prabhupada before this gentleman arrived. Prabhupada's looking through it. Herbert arrives. Sits himself down in front of Srila Prabhupada. I have been reading your book. Prabhupada says,
And Herbert starts chuckling. You know how many years it took me to write that book? It took me 30 years to write that book. Yes, Prabhupada says, and there are still mistakes. He says, if you actually want to know Krishna, you have to do like these boys and girls. And he's pointing to us around the room, saying, this is the age for enjoying. Well, they've given that up to know Krishna. So if you want to know Krishna, you have to do like they do. No illicit sex, no meeting, no gambling. And Jim Herbert, and I could give up smoking if I want to. I don't want to. Prabhupada says, yes, therefore you have a long way to go on your spiritual path. And they talked for a while longer. And then Prabhupada handed him a copy of Nectar of Devotion. And he said, I will request you to kindly read this book. And if you have questions, we can come back together and speak some more. Herbert thanked him, got up and made his way out. After these kinds of meetings, we would all kind of huddle. You know, like in the locker room after a football game, you know, to watch the videotape, you know. The post-mortem on these meetings. And so Prabhupada wasn't saying a word. We were expecting him to lambast him, you know, just lay into him. You know, another demon-type thing. Prabhupada was saying a thing. So Guru Gauranga looked at him and said, he was a big demon, wasn't he, Prabhupada? Prabhupada said, no, he's been contaminated by associating with the Mayavadis during the time that he was in India. But I see in his book that he has written the name Krishna many times, and that will benefit him greatly. Wow. He saw the good there. He saw what would help this man. You know, he chose to appreciate that he had written the name Krishna many times. That is amazing. Anyway, it was always like that. It's always something amazing. So in terms of, you know, moving forward, these stories for me are very telling. These memories are very informative. Some other questions that anyone would like to ask?
I have a question. There are times when Prabhupada was very compassionate in that way to people, and other times where he came down very heavy on them. So how, going forward, in the memory of Prabhupada's activities and responses to people, do we make the distinctions for ourselves?
By not imitating. Don't imitate Prabhupada. You can't do that. We've seen that too often, way, way too often. You know, people think that preaching means imitating the way Prabhupada did something. You know, you don't imitate. But, you know, neither do we have the authority to do that. Neither do we have the stature, you know, the provenance that he came with. We don't have any of that. We have to be extremely patient and understanding with people. I suspect, and again, this is me grousing a little bit as one of those first-generation devotees who looks back and tends to see the mistakes that we made. I tend to think that that was part of the dilemma, that we had this misimpression that we were meant to imitate Prabhupada instead of just doing what he would have had us do, which is to reach out and be friends with people. You know, sometimes the best kind of preaching is to listen. Think about that for a minute. People are lonely in this world. You know, they have no sense of purpose. And the greatest gift that you can give them is sometimes just to let them know that you're there for them and you care. So just listen to what they have to say. That's what Prabhupada did. Prabhupada listened. And then when he found some point where he could gradually introduce some Krishna consciousness, he did that. Mm.
Sometimes people would ask me that question as well, and I gave the answer you gave. Plus, we have to be ourselves. Krishna gave us who we are. But Can I talk still, or should I wait? Okay, thank you. So this man was talking to Prabhupada about how to manufacture baltis, which is a steel bucket. And he was a pretty boring man, and Prabhupada just listened. He listened. Then the man said, and then you take the steel band and you rivet it to the rest of the bucket. And then Prabhupada said, yes, this is the unalloyed attachment that one can have for Krishna. And he changed the conversation, and like you said, he went running, gave him devotional service, etc., etc.
I don't know if that, I mean, you're asking a very profound question. You know, we can give you Gurdas, anybody who knew Prabhupada can give you anecdotes to answer that. There's a way to, I don't usually use this phrase, it's a little corny. There's a way to speak truth to power. There's a way to speak to people in a way that lets them know that we cannot allow their misperception to go unanswered. But without being aggressive or bitter about it, you know, you can. The way to present something is with compassion. You know that. Excuse me for deviating again into subjects of you know international law and the Holocaust history. You know, and happens to be my alternate frame of reference, but. The entire history of international law has been an attempt to establish a balance between these two things. There's the concept of necessity, and there's the concept of humanity. Necessity says that if you are aggressed upon, you have the right to defend yourself any way necessary, to defend yourself, your family, your place of worship, whatever is needed, you have the legal right to do that. Humanity says that in that defensive response to aggression, you may not cause more harm than absolutely necessary. So your cause may be just, but if you do more harm in the pursuit of that cause, you will be held accountable for breaking international law, the rules of land warfare, international human rights conventions, whatever it may be. So we also still struggle with this. You know, we want to be uncompromising in our presentation of Krishna consciousness, and at the same time, we have to be compassionate. So I don't know if there's a simple answer to that question. And there are times when you stand up and be tough. Prabhupada once described that the entire Bhagavad Gita was spoken because Arjuna did not get angry when he was supposed to get angry. Arjuna, you know, what happens when you're faced with something you don't want to do? You rationalize it away. That's what Arjuna was doing. He was rationalizing. I shouldn't fight. The scriptures say this, and this is going to happen. And says, you know, and Krishna's listening to this. And what are you talking about? You know, these people are no longer entitled to your compassion. Now's the time for you to stand up. He says it. Stand up. Pick up your weapons. Stand and fight. So there are times when that's what we have to do. Most of the time, we just have to really cultivate extreme patience and compassion, because there, for the grace of God, go we. That person whom you find annoying and may have a difficult time talking with, that was you a few years ago. That was me a few years ago. And if there weren't people like Gurudas and Shamsundar and Malati and Mukunda, and, you know, who were patient with me when that was me, I wouldn't be here today. So it's all about, you know, really loving people for being parts and parcel of Krishna. That's the message. That's the takeaway from Prabhupada's life. You have to love people because they're part of Krishna.
I'm sorry?
You're saying that people recognize it when they see that you're actually going out of your way to want to help them, to try to help them?
Yeah.
Sure, of course. It's a rare thing. It's a cold world out there. It's really a cold world out there. I mean, we're very privileged. I mean, we're in an environment of all of these loving devotees. I mean, I come here and it's like, gosh, you know, what a wonderful place. But that's not how most people live. Most people live with sadness and feelings of being alone, you know, useless. Yeah.
I've worked with people like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they tell me their losses, frustrations, disappointments in life, and I just listen. And they're dying. Mm-hmm. And I carry with me a kit with holy water, with oil for Lord Shinha there, and I apply to their bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they die while I'm chanting the Maha Mantra. And I ask them, are you thirsty? And sometimes they can't talk. So I just grab for my kid Jamuna water and I put them in their lips. And I chant really loud in their ears. And then they leave the body.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to listen first. Like you said, what else can I do but listen?
Thank you. Thank you for your service. It's beautiful. Mm. Every one of us here in this room, we have some sphere of influence, some sphere of service. We have to look at that sphere of influence and say, what contribution can I make to Prabhupada's mission? What is the unique opportunity that Krishna has given me to help with Prabhupada's mission? That's your homework assignment here today. Yeah?
I was going to make a point when I heard you talking about how we have to listen and be empathetic and this and that, but you actually made the point, which I was going to make, but I'll make it another way also. You said that we have to be uncompromising and at the same time compassionate. I often, you're talking about grouses of devotees, so I'm going to grouse a bit too. I often hear a lot about compassion, but we don't hear so much about the uncompromising. People are suffering, that's true. Srila Prabhupada, among the many gifts and challenges he gave us, one of them was to combat and defeat the atheistic, demoniac society. These were terms that we learned from Srila Prabhupada. And compassion, yes. Empathy, yes. But we should remember this side of Prabhupada too, which was, at least in my mind, very pronounced. We all knew that Srila Prabhupada was very compassionate, but he also knew that he had a mission to challenge and to defeat all the demoniac and atheistic worldviews which are making people so miserable. So I wrote a whole book about that, actually. It's called On Speaking Strongly in Srila Prabhupada's Service.
Yeah, thank you. By the way, not everyone knows Bhakti Vigyan.
Bhakti Vikash.
Bhakti Vikash. There's a biography of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati out there that you have got to read, that he is the author of. It's amazing. I don't know how you managed to accomplish that. Thank you so much for that service. It's an amazing, amazing work. Look, we're called upon by our faith, our Vaishnava faith, to become more than we have been in the past. What it is we will be, we don't really know now. We are not only called upon, we're compelled to become more than we have been. And if I can just speak from my own experience, I think it's when I let go of my preoccupations with wanting to build a career, with wanting to make money,
with wanting to have some position, and I started remembering what was really important, things got a little clearer in my head. I'm not quite sure I'm explaining this well. But, you know, there are different stages of life. And during my third, I lived in temples for 13 years, and when I came out, you know, what skills did I have to offer a corporation? You know, fervent Sanskrit prayer? I mean, what, you know, what kind of a job was I qualified for? I didn't, you know. So naturally, without any qualification, I went into public relations. And the next step from there, obviously, was academia. So, and all along the way, you know, I had these ambitions and these aspirations to establish myself somehow so that I'd have a base of operation, you know. It didn't work. Maybe for other people, you know, more skilled at these things. There are people who have skills in business. Don't renounce those skills. If you have some skill, that's God-given. Use that. But be honest with yourself. If you don't have it, don't pretend. There are, Srila Prabhupada encouraged many people, for example, to do certain things and other people to never try those same things. Yadubara may be the only person I know of who was encouraged and given complete carte blanche by Srila Prabhupada to do films. The only person I know of. And I know a lot of people to whom he said, don't get involved in films. He knew that world of, you know, Hollywood and, you know, you're just going to get sucked in by that ego and you're going to be finished. Your whole spiritual life will be gone. Don't do that. So if you have some skills and you can exercise them properly, then, you know, do that. That's your contribution to helping expand Srila Prabhupada's mission. If you're a hospice worker or a hospital care person, or whether you're working in an office environment, there are a lot of people who come to classes up at Jiva Mukti Yoga in New York desperate to leave their job because they can't stand it anymore. They don't like what they're doing anymore. That's understandable. This is a tough one, though. If you don't have any other means of income, what do you do? So just slow down, you know. Find time to meet with devotees and talk more. Prabhupada was always encouraging us. See what I'm trying to do? I'm trying to, you know, like, give you some of that little takeaway stuff while wrapping in the memories of Prabhupada. Okay, here's another memory of Prabhupada. We're in Geneva. He had an invitation to go visit the World Health Organization. World Health Organization supports birth control, family planning. And he said, I'm concerned that if I go there, they'll take a picture of me, a photograph, and they'll say, this Swami supports our programs. What do you think? Well, Srila Prabhupada, I mean, it's just, you know, this is another United Nations sanctioned agency. That would be a rather tawdry way for them to behave. I don't think they need that kind of cheap publicity. You know, they stand on their own platform, and if they've extended the courtesy of an invitation, I think it's an opportunity for you to, well, then let's go. Now, he knew what he was going. He wanted us to make decisions. He wanted us to exercise, and sometimes, I mean, someone who's been on the GBC could correct me here, but I think if the GBC voted one way and he had a different idea at some point, he would let the GBC do what they decided best. Yeah. We're meant to work cooperatively. I'm deviating a little bit off the topic, but just kind of letting the conversation go where it wants to go. Rameshwara, you here?
Last of these survivors have left this world, and there's no one with direct memory around to continue remembering for others. And this is a very important topic for Prabhupada disciples and all the other followers of Prabhupada who will soon be in a world where there are no Prabhupada disciples left. I mean, it may be 10, 20 years from now, that will be the world. And how is Prabhupada to be remembered in that world?
Well, let me use the parallel that you've brought up. In the field of Holocaust studies, the general thinking is that you have to retain the personal element, the specificity. You can't talk about the Holocaust in general terms. You have to bring it down to specific terms. And the most specific terms, those which move people most, are witness testimony. So we have Siddhanta's tapes. We have memoirs that people are writing. My dear godbrother Shamsundar is coming out with a magisterial, multi-part epic of his memories of Srila Prabhupada. Those remembrances are important there. Having the testimony on videotape is important because then you don't just read words on a page. Video unleashes the emotion and the pacing and the return of memory that's held captive on a page. When you read words on a page, they're all given the same time sequence. When I talk with you and you see me going off into some kind of space for a moment, I'm back there with Prabhupada. I'm remembering that moment. And by me returning to that moment, it allows me to speak with you and convey an emotion and a palpable sense of the reality of that moment that you won't get just reading something I might say on a printed page. So video testimony is a very important component. I don't know if I have a good answer to give you other than this one, which is that Prabhupada lives in our hearts. And not just those who had his personal association. Anyone who follows him. Prabhupada dwells in your heart. And if you give yourself sincerely to him, and if you follow the basics, if you're chanting your rounds, if you're careful about your diet, if you're respecting, honoring prasadam. I know I've had to go through a whole rethinking about my relationship with food. I mean, completely. Some of this will be revealed. There is an almost mystical dimension to this that I cannot give you a rational explanation for. But some of it will come. The best thing I can say is keep association. Prabhupada lives where we remember him and glorify him. So perhaps you have some other dimension you'd want to add to that.
What is going on in Srimad Bhagavatam? We also have, as we read that, we understand we're right there in the Namasharanya forest, hearing it with the saintly persons. It's timeless. So we go back there, and I foresee as long as Prabhupada's books are here, that there is always that chance for someone to have that personal meeting with Prabhupada.
That was nice. Thank you.
I didn't have to say it because she said it.
All right, let me throw a challenge out there to those of you who had Prabhupada's association. What about the memories you don't want to remember? You know, memory is selective. I think someone said that yesterday. There are things we may choose to not remember, or that we will remember in our own way, which may be different from the way it actually was. Why is that? Well, it's not as simple as, you know, I messed up and Prabhupada caught me on it. It wasn't quite. Sure, there's that element of embarrassment about some memory that you might feel a little awkward repeating. But I think there's a deeper dimension to certain memories of Srila Prabhupada. And it has to do with the fact that to become Krishna conscious, really, don't underestimate how deep our conditioning goes. We're very conditioned, very, very conditioned. And there are habits that we have and ways of thinking. Why do we get so distracted by these different kinds of, you know, gossipy, you know, why? I was asked to do a mediation with a temple in Queens. There's a group of devotees from Guyana. And they just can't get along. They just can't get along. And they were talking about this one who did this to that one, and that one did this to that one, and you know, and then this they said about that one, and this. I'm saying, how do you live with this? How are you able to absorb yourself so amazingly in such trivia and details and scandal? You know, how are we able to do that? You know, can't we elevate this conversation just a little bit above the water? And they said, you know what? They said, you know, Yogeshwar, we come from a little island. And growing up on a little island, that's really pretty much what you do. You know, everybody knows everybody's business. So we've brought that with us into Krishna consciousness. And they were quite, you know, candid about it. So our conditioning goes very deep. Each one of us has our own something that we have to eventually give up. Now, I can't, you have to figure out, you plug your own story into this. I can't tell you what it is. But each of us has something that we're holding on to that's holding us back from that full experience of surrender to Prabhupada. And sometimes the memories, at least for myself, I'm speaking now, of times when I was there with him, are touched, they come so close to touching that last anchor that I've got inside me. And I don't always know exactly what it is. But I almost set that day aside. And I don't talk about that day. Because it's existentially threatening to me. You know, I leave here tomorrow. I go back to New York. I get out of these robes. I don't wear robes. You know, I go back into my bar mitzvah suit, you know. And I'm basically invisible, you know, except for my neck beads. And I walk down the street, and no one would know I'm a devotee. You know. Each of us has something that we're holding. Something's holding us back. And I think, okay, so now I got to come clean, right? Now I've said that. Now I got to give you an example, right? Well, did I tell you about Thailand yesterday? There was a gentleman in Bangkok who invited the devotees from Paris to come and visit him, and he said if we came, he would introduce us to some people there. And so the young woman who had been this man's assistant in business and who became a devotee in Paris asked me if I would go. So Prabhupada was there, and I went in and explained the situation. And he looked at me. This was the first time after having met him many times and having spent a lot of time with him. There was a different kind of an expression in his face. He was sitting behind his desk. I was standing up. He looked up at me like this and he said, "Take this opportunity to preach, and Krishna will bless you." Uh-oh. That was the Prabhupada I had hoped I wouldn't have to confront. That soldier for Krishna who wants to drag me into battle. He wants me to go and become a preacher in Thailand. And it scared the heck out of me. I don't have that. I don't have that kind of missionary zeal. You know, I can talk a good game. I mean, I can sit up here and tell you some nice stories and, you know, wow you with my, you know, Sanskrit or whatever. But when it comes right down to it, I'm not a world preacher, you know. And I'm kind of attached to having a somewhat comfortable life and a family. So I said, well, can I bring my wife with me? He said, the husband needs the wife to protect him. All right. Now I've told you one of my embarrassing moments. No, but my point is that there are things that maybe we don't want to remember, or parts of the philosophy that we don't really want to examine, because that's existentially threatening somehow. This part of the philosophy, we have to give this up. Now, that giving up of something, sometimes I think can be. And what was Prabhupada, if not the embodiment of? He had no attachment. There was a child who came to him in his room in Paris. And anyone who knew Prabhupada from those days knows that his desk was a study of perfection. Everything had its place. The pen was in the pen box. You know, the stationery was there. The photo of his Guru Maharaj was there, of Radha, the deities were there. The desk, his cup was there with a little, you know, little plate on top to keep it from getting dust in it, and the picture, it was perfect. And every place, we were very careful to make sure that desk was. Along comes this little kid, you know, crawling up to his desk, boom, 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 you know, just going everywhere. And Prabhupada just sat there watching it all. You know? Now, if that had been my desk, that kid would have been a basketball. You know, it's like, bye. He was unattached to all of these things on his desk. He just had no attachment at all. Just watching. Maybe waiting for one of us to stop the child from messing up his desk. But I can't remember that he had any particular, you know, he was attached to his spiritual master's order. I'm wandering again. Any other questions? Yeah. All right, here and then here.
Very scholarly, very Krishna-conscious classes. And there's a common theme that I picked up in a lot of his classes, and maybe I could just mention it and have you see if you could expand upon it a little bit. And he said the most important thing in Krishna consciousness is to know where we're at in terms of our own individual spiritual development.
Was there a question there?
Yeah, I'm just wondering if you could expand on that a little bit.
Well, if you're asking me to interpret that it's important for us to know where we are in our spiritual progress, is that more or less the idea?
Well, we've got only 10 minutes left. So rather than go into these ontological questions of our own spiritual life, can we just request at this point in time to give Yogeshwar Prabhu 10 minutes to kind of just sum up and maybe enlighten us a little more with some Prabhupada pastimes of his own.
So come afterwards and we'll talk. Okay. I think he wants me to sum up. I'll come outside afterwards. We'll talk some more outside. So just give me half a second to wow you once again with my closing remarks now. It ain't over, guys. It's just beginning. It's just beginning. Sometimes people ask me, why have we had to go through such trauma? We've been through such difficulties. The only reasonable explanation I can think of is that Krishna is so kind. It took the Roman Catholic Church 2,000 years to become the largest institution in the world, and they still have it wrong. We're getting all of our mistakes in the first 50 years. from here on, we should be able to look back and say, hey, wait a minute, you know, we tried that in 72 and it didn't work. So we won't have to make the mistakes again. So let's just learn from the past and move forward, recognizing that what Prabhupada came to give is a living, breathing thing. It is not some box of knowledge that you just pass along to the next generation. Krishna consciousness, there are basics that will never change. But we've got to have a new language with which to express those teachings so that people will understand what we mean for the rest of the world. To 99.99% of the world, we're still irrelevant. We mean nothing to them. We have an obligation to describe our relevance. No one's calling. The phone's not ringing. No one is inviting us to join their think tank for the next generation of, you know, environmental projects. No one is asking devotees to come and give their advice on what the next kind of governmental administration should be. They should be calling us. We've got a lot to say. But have we taken the time to actually sit down and articulate what our positions are on these things? I've talked about this a few times with some of the people here. In the peacekeeping initiative, in the peace world, there are two tracks of diplomacy. One is called track one diplomacy and the other is track two diplomacy. Track one diplomacy are the Hillary Clintons and the Condoleezza Rices and the Henry Kissingers of history. They represent a government. They go in. Everything they say between two disputants is reported by the press. What are those disputants going to say? They're not going to say anything because everything they say is going to be reported to the rest of the world because it's Hillary Clinton. Track two is very often religious and spiritual leaders whom you will never read about in the newspapers. You'll never hear anything about what they're doing because track two means anonymous. They work behind closed doors. I've seen this operating in Kyoto. I went to a gathering of religious leaders in Kyoto, and there were people from the Arab nations and from Israel meeting behind closed doors. If any of their constituents had an inkling that they were sitting down together, they would have been summarily dismissed or worse from their posts. But because there's a spiritual person there in the middle, the thinking is, I can trust you. I can trust you. You're a man of God. You're a woman of God. You may not like me. You may not like what I'm doing. But I can trust you to take a message to my enemy because I know you have my interests at heart. You love me because you're a person of God. I can trust you. And there has been more done to arrive at disarmament, détente, resolution of conflict by these behind-the-scenes negotiators than you will ever know about. There are some instances. You take the Nigerian Civil War of 1968. The traditional channels failed to resolve that civil war. Government agencies, UN agencies, NGOs, financial and business interests, the military, nobody could stop it. Quaker mediators came in and they resolved it. The civil war ended. We should be doing that. We should be doing that. We should have peace negotiators going into hot spots of the world and bringing some understanding, because we have such knowledge, such amazing knowledge. In fact, I would go so far as to say, and I believe this would be Srila Prabhupada's message rather than my own message, you cannot solve any of the world's problems if you do not address the question of consciousness first. Anything that you do in any area of conflict, any area of environmental decay, any area of anything, will never be resolved unless you understand the foundational teachings of the Bhagavad Gita. Why should I love you? It's a nice Hallmark card. I will love you forever. You know? Why should I love you? I love you because you're my family. We're all children of Krishna. We're all parts and parcels of Krishna. Therefore, I have a reason to love you. I have a reason to get past the things that you may say or do that are harmful or hurtful to me. Without that, what hope is there? And I'll tell you the truth. It's as applicable in your own personal relationships as it is in world affairs. You bring what Prabhupada has brought us by way of an understanding of people as eternal souls into your relationships, into your home, your family, your children, your partners. And you will begin to see this person is a spirit soul struggling inside that body just like I am. I really ought to have more understanding for this person. Maybe there's something I haven't tried that will salvage this relationship. I'm honored by having been asked to come and share whatever little memories I have of Srila Prabhupada with you. And more than that, I'm really humbled to see what you're doing here as a community. It's very inspiring. Thank you all very much for your attention and questions. Hare Krishna.
Thank you, Yogeshwara Prabhu. And we hope that you will return many times to the Prabhupada Festival. So now we'll prepare for the reading of the deities, and Prabhupada Pushpasama will do. So we're going to have a little kirtan before the bathing of Srila Prabhupada, which is running a tiny bit late.
I've taught computers and graphics in college. Those are skills. I think you really hit on it. You know, it's a